Good morning, everybody, and thank you for being quiet and coming to our roundtable here at CSIS. Let me begin by saying that for many years now, we have been focused in Washington on the soft power policies and capabilities of the United States, of NATO, and of the European Union. In other words, how the transatlantic countries seek to promote their values and interests, especially in the former communist bloc in Europe's east. Including democracy, pluralism, rule of law, market economics, inter-ethnic coexistence, interstate accords, and eventual integration into both NATO and the EU. In other words, the good things of life. Unfortunately, only limited attention has been paid to the soft power generated by the Russian Federation, particularly the Russian government, towards its immediate neighbors. So today we aim to fill a little bit of this gap in understanding in our roundtable. Questions are, for example, what are Russia's state interests and political and cultural values that it seeks to promote in such diverse countries as Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia? What instruments does Moscow employ in promoting these interests and values, and how consistent is it? And more importantly, how successful has Russia been, or have the soft power tools actually provoked a backlash against Russia's influences, Russia's interests among former Soviet republics and former satellites? So to answer some of these questions and many others, we are very happy to have with us today researchers from the Center for East European Policy Studies in Riga, Latvia. They will be presenting and condensing a very substantial, I haven't read it yet, I've read summaries, but a very substantial and substantive report. It only took them a few months to do it, I just asked, that they have just released on Russia's use of culture, language, media, education, public diplomacy, et cetera, to legitimize its foreign policy objectives. So let me introduce them very briefly. I think you have the bios with you, and then we'll turn to them. Each has, or three of them have PowerPoints, so we have plenty of, we're going to have plenty of information, and then we'll try and have as much time as possible for discussion. Our four researchers today, in order of appearance, Andis Kudors, Executive Director of the Center for East European Policy Studies since 2006. His main research interests are current trends in foreign policy in Eastern Europe and the post-Soviet countries, and he is particularly focused on the political culture of Russia and Russia's so-called compatriots policy. Second, Gatis Pelnens is a researcher, again, at the Center for East European Policy Studies and a student of political science at the University of Latvia. His research focuses on security, international politics, terrorism, Russia's foreign policy, and the Baltic Sea region. Third, Martins Paparinskis, DPhil candidate, University of Oxford, writing his thesis on investment protection and the right to regulate. He's the author of numerous publications on legal questions, including those pertaining to interstate relations, international law, and so forth. And fourth, Nerius Maliukevicius, scientific researcher at Vilnius University, Institute of International Relations and Political Science, and his fields of study include media and political conflict, international relations, information wars, and Russian foreign policies. He is also director of the European Integration Study Center in Lithuania. So, Andis, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Bugarski.
Call me Andis.
Thank you. My presentation will be a little bit later on. I will speak about compatriots policy. And I just want to start with some... I want to thank Mr. Janusz Bugajski and Ilona Telecki for having us here. We are happy to be in Washington, D.C. and disseminate our books. And first time in Washington, I was in year 2007, I met another... fellow from Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mr. Andrew Kachins.
He's detained today. I mean, not literally, but couldn't.
Yeah, and I remember I told him that we have idea to make research, to make study about Russian foreign policy toward neighboring countries, and especially about soft power activities. And I came once again in year 2008, And once again, I explained we have idea to make this study. And I remember Mr. Kachin said, Andis, you already told me that 1 year ago. And then I realized I cannot come to here without books. So I'm happy that this time, this is third time I'm here, but I'm happy that there is a book on my hands. So unfortunately, Mr. Kachin is not here, but my greetings to him.
I'll tell him the book is done.
Yes, thank you. And I'd like to thank also our financial supporters. There were several of them, Konrad Adenauer Stiftung or Foundation, and Soros Foundation in Latvia. And after we made this book, we had information campaign in six countries, in all focus countries of this study, in Baltic states, in Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia. And those were interesting seminars and interesting presentations. We had a lot of interested guests and journalists to our topic. Especially in Georgia, there were a lot of all of Georgian TV channels were in our presentation. So, and we had good discussions, and those discussions also helped us to get new information about those countries which we discovered before. So, and thank you also to National Endowment for Democracy, which supported this information campaign in which we had those six seminars. I'm happy to give floor to Gatis Pelnens, our director of our study of this book, and floor is yours.
Thank you, Andis. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm also really happy to see a lot of people here today. Andis said all the thanks already for everyone, so I must stick to the more formal part of the presentation. Hope it's all right, yeah. Well, the subject of our study is foreign policy actions of one state, in our case Russia, towards its neighbors. And well, the first thing to look at when we do some study on this object is that, well, why to study Russia in our countries? And our interest on studying Russia is actually quite simple. It's because we are cautious about everything that Russia does, and we are aware of its actions that are directed towards us, especially towards us. There are a lot of images of harm and threats and so on, which can be also false regarding Russia in our countries. At the same time, when you live near the cave of the bear, you must always be ready that the spring will come soon and the bear will be awake from the winter's fall. And what makes us even more cautious regarding Russia is not just living nearby it, but also its official position, its recent policy trends and goals that are officially stated by Russia. When speaking of recent trends in Russian foreign policy, we can see that it reveals the ambition of Russia to get back to the status of great power. And, of course, this also implies the more aggressive stance towards the West. This raises kind of concerns about the new Cold War emerging and so on, mostly in the West. At the same time, similar notion can be seen in case of Russia also. Here you can see the quote of Dmitry Furman, where he speaks of really enemies engaging Russia, and this is really another report from the military strategic papers and so on. Also, Furman talks about the strategies of soft power that actually West is imposing against Russia. So we can see that not only we see Russia becoming maybe more controversial and more contradictive to the West, but also in Russia they see the same. And this is really very important when looking at the development of Russian foreign policy, also on its soft power and the, as we have the book here on the humanitarian dimension, as they call it. I will explain the difference later on. Well, the one thing was were the recent trends in Russian foreign policy of the great power and confrontation with the West. The other thing that relates more closely to the countries of the study are the officially posed foreign policy goals of Russia, where it has said that it wants to become a pole of power for the post-Soviet space, and that this space, its neighboring countries, are the zone of exclusive interests. Well, and I think you must agree, this can make the small countries living nearby really cautious about everything that the big country can do. At the same time, well, we have seen in the previously that for achieving these goals, Russia has tried to use and also has used the hard power means. There's an example of Georgia. There are also examples on Ukraine, on gas crisis. At the same time, these means of hard power didn't give the result that Russia would really want to get. And so diversification of the instruments of foreign policy and developing the instruments of foreign policy was actually introduced as a new trend in Russia's foreign policy development and implementation. And here we can then see the humanitarian trend of Russian foreign policy rising up at the year 2007. At this point, humanitarian trend was defined as such in Russian Federation's foreign policy review. And as you can see, it defines like five major issues where Russia wants to spread its humanitarian influence. And this is the core of what we were trying to analyze and what we were studying within our study. That's why we also took title, which is officially defined by Russia in this foreign policy review, which is humanitarian dimension and not soft power. The difference here, difference is actually quite simple. There are things that directly comply with the within the humanitarian trend. There are things that directly comply with the original notion of soft power, the culture, the education, media, and so on. At the same time, there are things that are not so close to the original notion of soft power. There are campaigns of aspersion, there are criticism, manufacturing of enemy images of the neighboring countries within and abroad Russia. And this actually, well, kind of makes a difference. It is a soft power in most of the structure of humanitarian trend, of this dimension of Russian foreign policy. At the same time, it also implies something more. So we can say that Russia has gone farther than the original fathers of the soft power in this sense. So, now I'll just quickly run through the. This is the structure of our study, how we made it. Basically, the research design was built up by two parts. The conceptual part, where we tried to reveal the elements of the humanitarian trend. Also, we followed the development of this humanitarian dimension in Russia's foreign policy before 2007. How it has evolved, all the issues, you know, of the media, protection of the compatriots, human rights issues, and so on, how they have been stated before. And the third thing within the conceptual part was trying to put the humanitarian actions of Russia within the framework of soft power, because we found that it is the at least now, it is the most precise theoretical framework through which we can view these actions of Russia. Then the second part is the empirical study, which consists of the case studies and comparative analysis of our results. Each of the case studies was done by each research center from every country. It means that in case of Latvia, it was done by researchers from Latvia. In case of Lithuania, researchers from Lithuania. There were altogether six research centers working each on its own case study. So, and we kind of had the idea of and of the criteria of each area of the humanitarian dimension, the human rights, compatriots, the consular issues, culture, education, and media. At the same time, we found out during the work that some things do not stick so well together when comparing them between the countries. So at that point, we kind of also let the researchers from each country to modify these criteria so they can have the results that show the real picture of what's happening within there. And of course, the comparative study was made in a different style. Then we went through the each of the areas of this humanitarian dimension and comparing what are the differences between the states, between the countries of the study. So this is the basic structure of our work. And now for more detailed review on each of the areas, we will all have the presentations. And first, I would like to give word to Marius Paparinskis, who will elaborate on the issue of human rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Gatis. And may I just say thank you to Dr. Bugajski for his very kind words of introduction. In the fast-moving world that we are now living in, biographies sometimes fail to catch up with developments in real life, so I say that at the moment I'm also very privileged, apart from Oxford Association, to be a host of research scholar at New York University. I'd like to discuss the human rights perspective of our project, and I think it should be taken as a fair health warning that, unlike my colleagues, I'm a mere international lawyer. I'm familiar with the subtleties of international relations and politics, so it is not entirely inconceivable that my presentation will have a slightly more formalistic bend than that of my friends. I would like to make a number of points. First, I would like to make a few introductory remarks about the book itself. Secondly, I would like to say something about what we are not arguing. Thirdly, I would like to make a few points of concern. Fourthly, make some suggestions, and finally have a brief postscript. As Gatti suggested, the project's purpose was to consider how the same issue, in my case, human rights practice, has been applied in all these states. So the researchers consider the way how human rights arguments have been invoked by Russia against a particular state in different international fora, in bilateral relations, in international relations, in different international organizations, United Nations, General Assembly, Security Council, in the Council of Europe, in the relationship between the particular countries and European Union, in international courts and tribunals as well. As one might expect, there were certain similarities and there were certain dissimilarities, and for these formalistic differences, I kindly invite you to read the book itself. Let me just move the point to say what we are not arguing. We are certainly not suggesting that there's anything peculiar for states to invoke human rights arguments in their international practice. Human rights arguments have great legitimacy in contemporary legal order, and many states, United States among them, traditionally invokes it and them to justify certain policy propositions. So there's nothing peculiar about that. The second point is that we are not saying that it's anything peculiar that Russia's arguments are perhaps not generally accepted. Reasonable people may disagree about what the binding human rights rules are, and indeed if we look at the particular pieces that we considered, in particular in relation to Georgia and Georgia's claim against Russia in the International Court of Justice relating to the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, I dare say that the Russian position that the convention did not apply extraterritorially would not be totally unlikely to have certain sympathy from the official United States position. So again, that is not something that we are saying. What we are saying and what seems to have a certain concern for us is that there doesn't seem to exist a minimal internal coherence between arguments that are advanced in different fora. And again, just to bracket out, there is always a likelihood that legal arguments would be made with greatest force when one's opponent, or at least a person or the state with which one disagrees, is guilty or allegedly guilty of certain breaches and vice versa. That is also nothing exceptional. What seems to be interesting in the Russian human rights practice are a number of points. The first point is the form in which the practice is usually expressed, which seems, for want of a finer word, slightly rude, particularly in relation to propositions where the Russian view is not entirely a mainstream one. A good example is in relation to the Baltic states, where the human rights issues are closely intertwined with historically legal context of the occupation and unlawful annexation of Baltic states from 1940 to 1990. Indeed, something where probably most states would take the view that that was unlawful, and very few states, indeed historically, primarily Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, would take the opposite view. Russia takes the view that that was perfectly lawful and a very jolly good thing to do for the Soviet Union to annex Baltic states. And here, again, the point that we want to emphasize is that the form in which it is expressed is not something that one would usually find in civilized international discourse. It rather emphasizes an absolutely inconceivable proposition that that could have been unlawful. So there's a sort of, as a distinguished former NYU professor, late NYU professor Tom Frank said, that it doesn't seem to pass the laugh test. That is the first point. The second point relates to the coherence, not between the position of Russia and the world at large, but between different positions that Russia takes in different contexts. And there is a close relationship between human rights arguments and arguments relating to really the use of force and such good old-school realpolitik legal propositions. In the context of Moldova and Georgia, human rights arguments have been used in the context of de facto control and, as some would argue, creeping annexation of parts of these states, as in particular the arguments that Russia used in August of 2008 in the military actions and war with Georgia. It is interesting to point to the incoherence of Russian position with its own earlier position in relation to Kosovo, where, as you might recall, Russia was one of the chief opponents of the propositions that there may be a reason for humanitarian intervention in case of broad breaches of human rights, as well as more particularly that there could be a proposition for granting statehood in case where human rights have been gravely breached. It took Russia, indeed in real time, probably about 3 or 4 hours to change its very strongly, seemingly strongly held position to a one that in case of genocide, intervention can take place and statehood can be granted. Again, another strata or stratum of incoherence here is a position in relation to genocide, where Russia takes a very critical view that the so-called Holodomor of early 1930s in Ukraine can be qualified as genocide, while it had much lesser problems in qualifying the deaths of what now seems to be about 100 persons in military actions as genocide. As it seems to me that it goes slightly further than traditional coherence of international politics. Perhaps an interesting perspective could be that of Anne-Marie Slaughter, who a number of years ago suggested that there one could draw a distinction between liberal and illiberal states in international law, that liberal states are those who, whether they succeed or not, do take legal arguments seriously and go about implementing them quite seriously. And illiberal states are those where legal arguments play absolutely no role. And of course, there's a spectrum between these propositions. There have been critiques, but on the basis of research, it seems to us that the arguments that very rarely pass a laugh test and absolute incoherence between either internal or external perspective of these arguments could put Russia in the latter category of Anne-Marie Slaughter's categorization. And that, of course, would also help us with the otherwise rather troubling question whether the democracies and liberal democracies really make war with each other, as in Russia and Georgia case. Let me move now to my pretty last point. What do I suggest? What would be a good way for the states that have been the focus of Russia's attention to proceed? And as perhaps you're not entirely unsurprised to hear from an international lawyer, I suggest that heavier legalistic argumentation would be in order. It is an unremarkable proposition, but sometimes it's good to make explicit what is unremarkable, that there are different arguments and different degrees of relevance in different settings of dispute settlement. Things that are relevant when war goes on are irrelevant in bilateral and multilateral diplomacy and are absolutely relevant in a court of law. It seems to me that Georgia is an excellent example for a good appreciation of relative strengths and weaknesses of different approaches and different fora. Clearly, on the military level, Russia has a great deal of advantage. As a veto-wielding P5 power, it has a very good advantage in the Security Council and United Nations, and as a entity controlling facts on the ground, it has been able to act quite conclusively in the context of Council of Europe. However, when the dispute settlement perspective switches to a more formalized context, as when Georgia has launched cases against Russia in the European Court of Human Rights and International Court of Justice, the positions are suddenly equal. There is really nothing that the real world power matters now. And that seems to me to be the right perspective for which other states could proceed, to try to equalize the relative powers by formalizing the fora in which the disputes are settled. May I just add a final postscript with a perhaps minorly critical twist? If I'm not entirely mistaken, we are discussing this from the perspective of new democracies being around Russia and Eurasia. I'm not entirely sure that it is accurate to characterize at least Baltic states as new democracies. We would rather see ourselves as old democracies, as states which in 1920s had our own democratic constitutions, our own democratic traditions, and the parliaments and the constitutional assemblies that were elected on the basis of free and equal elections. So we would rather see ourselves as part of the democratic tradition rather than something which has unexpectedly appeared anew. Thank you.
It's me. Thank you, Martins, for his presentation, well, for his speech. As I said before, I will explain some basic points about competitors' policy as we are seeing it from our countries and from our point of view. And Russian competitors' policy is a part of humanitarian trend of foreign policy. As we see in this overview of Russian foreign policy from year 2007, there are interesting words which we took as a basis to show attitude of Russia to compatriots living abroad. And there will be one quotation from Foreign Policy Review from 2007. As a result of collapse of USSR, tens of millions of our people found themselves outside the country. It means from outside of Russia. And those words, our people, show the ambitions of Russia. And there is nothing unique, like we can see there are a lot of countries who are quite active in compatriots' policies, like, for example, China or Poland or Hungary or Israel. And what is specific in our case, that this ambition to see a target group, to see as eventual compatriots a large number of our societies. I want to stress that Russia sees as a Russian compatriots living abroad not just Russian citizens who are living abroad, but also so-called Russian speakers. And in that case, there are a lot of Russian speakers. For example, like me and Gatis also, we are Russian speakers because we can speak in Russian language also. Our native language is Latvian, but if we are outside of Latvia, we as children of former Soviet citizens, according to law of Russian compatriots policy law, which was adopted in 1999, we can be Russian compatriots. If we are living here, for example, in the United States, as a former USSR, not citizens, but children of former citizens of USSR, we can be compatriots. So why I'm saying that? Because this question, who is Russian compatriot, is still open. Yes, there is definition in this law I mentioned, but there is also discussion inside in Russia continues about who are Russian compatriots. And in early 90s, about compatriots, basically spoke nationalistic politicians in Russia. After Putin came to the power, situation changed, and we can see that financial support is increasing with every program for assistance of compatriots. And institutions involved, we can see they are in all levels of power of Russia, there are some division or commission or committee or department which work with compatriots. And it became quite active policy after colored revolutions in the Russian neighboring countries. And about programs, there are programs in Russia for assistance for compatriots for 3 years, and nowadays there is a program which started in 2009 till 2011. Before that, first program was from 2006 to 2008, and we can see that in first program there were allotted 40 million of Russian rubles for this first period, and then for second period from 2009 to 2011 there was about 400 million of rubles. We can see this tendency. And I'd like to say some words also about ideological concept of Russian world. And this notion was not new. There is a history of centuries for Russian world, but in this Russian foreign policy overview from 2007, also there is mentioned Russian world, and there is one of definition you can see that Russian world is a phenomenon of ethnic culture having a network structure consisting of large and small communities within the Russian culture and language environment, and taking Russia as the mental center. Also, in the same foreign policy review of 2007, there is written that culture, Russian culture, has to be tool of foreign policy. And we can see in this Russian world concept that they want to implement it through this Russian world, this idea. And one of the cornerstones of Russian world concept is that is Russian language. And one of the authors, Pyotr Shedrovitsky, which ideas is implemented in Russian foreign policy documents, he stressed out that those people who speak in everyday life Russian language, those also think in Russian, and as a result will act in Russian. It's some kind of constructivist approach, and this is not new idea. We remember German philosopher Herder from 18th century, which also stressed that there is correlation between language and way of thinking. And also about civilization and values. Another idea of Russian world means that Russia, together with diasporas abroad, is like archipelago, like network network system, which can unite Russian diasporas with Russia, and this is also not new idea. And after 2007, after Russia made this foundation of Ruski Mir or Russian World, they are quite active to try to consolidate the Russian community abroad. If we speak about problems of competitors' policy, and if we see to competitors' policy from soft power perspective, that we can see there is a self-canceling effect. That, for example, if with support of Russian World idea and with this Ruski Mir Foundation or Russian World Foundation, they want to create some attractiveness of Russia, some attractiveness of Russian culture, with hard power elements, they just cancel it. Like after, for example, war in Georgia, this is difficult to speak about attractiveness of Russian culture, for example, in Georgia. But nevertheless, there are some problems of from soft power perspective. If we look at target group of Russian competitors' policy, that there can be some problems in future. Like, for example, if we take two examples, Ukraine and Latvia, according to Latvia's law, it's forbidden for political parties to have financial support from abroad. But this is not forbidden for non-governmental organizations. And situation in Latvia is quite interesting because there are a lot of politicians from some pro-Russian political parties who are, and those politicians are quite active in activities of NGOs who has financial support from Russia. Ruski Mir Foundation, through grants, give financial support, and before elections, politicians are quite active in activities of that kind of NGOs. Legally, there is no problem, but if you see, like, in political sense, this is problem, because this is not direct way, but some indirect way for political parties in Latvia to get financial support from Russia through those NGOs. And also one example for Ukraine situation, there are a lot of Russian compatriots, NGOs in Crimea, and as you know, there is a Russian fleet base in Sevastopol, and the agreement ends between Ukraine and Russia in 2017, and a lot of, not a lot of, but several officers from Russian army are quite active participants of compatriots NGO in Crimea. And they like to say that they will do everything possible to keep Russian base in Sevastopol. And also, compatriots organizations in Ukraine, they are quite active to disseminate specific ideas. For example, that there is no difference between ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians. We have common history, this is the same country, and Crimea belongs to Russia. And before year 2017, we can probably, maybe there will be some activities from those NGOs. So, and I hope there will be also questions, and we can go maybe on the end more in detail about compatriots policy. So, thanks.
Now we will change once more.
Physical activities, right?
Okay, thank you once again. There were lots of thanks. From my part, I probably would like to thank Latvian colleagues that probably this is a rare case when we have such a project and report done and concluded to the result. So I thank you and keep up the good organizing work. When we started the discussion, Mr. Janusz asked how humanitarian dimension differs from soft power. I think this is the question to the point. The answer would be how the concept, Western concept of democracy differs from Russian concept of sovereign democracy, or how the concept of effective management differs from the concept of vertical власти, vertical of power. So I think this is very important to have a deep knowledge of the content that is put into the Russian foreign policy concepts. And I think this is an excellent example with this project that we went into this content trying to understand how Russia for itself defines humanitarian dimension. And I think we have some results. Just to finish with this remark, Sergei Lavrov in his review of past year events, he put forward that, and in the future, Russia will work on humanitarian dimension, and to put it in Russian terming, he said that this is a modernizatsiya of the foreign policy, and you know what modernizatsiya in Medvedev's rhetoric means. So I think this is a good time to start researching humanitarian dimension. I would start by presenting you how actually Russian NGOs working on those soft power issues view such policies. What is quite interesting, actually, how the head of Estonian Pushkin Institute views his aims and tasks. And he puts it quite into concrete terms, speaking about that language is an important geopolitical factor. Therefore, geopolitics in this soft social environment for Russia is very important. I would move into the media issue, and I would like to explain my understanding of how Russia views its media policies. I would name it Russian geopolitics of information, not Russian soft power policies, but geopolitics of information, where the major, aim is to have a domination or control of communication channels, and afterwards you can use different strategies to achieve your aims. And soft power or attractiveness is just one of the strategies, and we could go through carrots or sticks, you know, the ideas of how to work with the Baltics. Yes, in Yeltsin's times, when Vyacheslav Nikonov was working, you know, in Council for Foreign and Defense Policy, he suggested working with the Baltics in a soft way. Then we have different polytechnologists coming into the play, and then we have the attitude of Russia doesn't need to be loved by its neighbors. We can achieve our goals, you know, through the stick policy in the media environment. I'm speaking about media conflicts, history conflicts, and so on and so on. And then we have, again, a change in the actors in this policy, Vyacheslav Nikonov taking this position with the Ruski Mir Foundation, and again going into this soft policy. So we have hawks changing doves, doves changing hawks, but the idea of Russian work in the media environment is very much about control issues, very much about geopolitical domination issues in this soft media realm. I would like to present one document about the question about what strategy should be used in this environment. With Russia, what I think is very difficult for researchers is the problem of not being transparent system to be researched. The question, who is working on the policies, who is doing the job, who is creating the strategies? For us, it is very difficult to answer. And then you tend to think about the analogies, and I would bring the analogy from Soviet times. And this is a lucky example when we can take out the document that Mr. Bukovsky managed to take out from the archives in modern Russia about how Soviet Union views its ideological work in 86-87 in Finland. There are many points, and many points could be taken, you know, now to humanitarian dimension issues, but as a media presentation, I would like to stick to the major one. This is the first channel, the ORT channel, that should do the media work in Finland in this case. And what is said in this document is that the major idea is to have inside presence in Finland through cable televisions, to have ORT or First Channel be present in cable televisions. What we have now in the whole post-Soviet Union is the result of this strategy. Actually, having daughter or how to say daughter companies of First Channel working in the Baltics, and this would be international channel for the Baltics. Then there's channel for Moldova, First Channel Prima. Then there's channels for all over other post-Soviet countries. So I would tend to solve a problem of Russia being a closed environment to researchers and you not being able to answer questions about how Russia works in media environment, just to try to use analogies of Soviet times to this day work. And now when we are moving into how this information environment is in the sense occupied in the Baltic states, and how it is possible, it is a simple competitive advantage or advantageous situation for Russia to do this. Yes, there are sizable Russian ethnic minorities, and through media, what Andis said, that it is worked on this soteczestvenniki or compatriots issue. Then there's a language issue. In Lithuania, we've done a research just years ago, and the question was, are you able to understand Russian, not to speak, not to write, not other capabilities, but to understand in order to watch television? The answer was 80% are able to understand Russian and are able to watch Russian media products and listen or read to those. So we have a significant portions of our societies living in Russian media environment. To present the case, I would like just to show you a Lithuanian case. We had a question through nationalities in Lithuania. How often do you watch following TV channels? And PBK, this is the first Baltic channel in Lithuania. So Lithuanians are watching quite insignificantly, yeah? But then when we turn to Russians, we have such results, yes? If we turn what is quite interesting in Lithuania to Poles, we have significant results as well. This is a question for discussion about the identity of Lithuanian Poles. And if we turn to Estonian Russian speakers, we have enormously different result in a negative sense. You can see Estonian television in the bottom, and the question, which channels do they watch most? PBK, 33%, and other Russian channels. Estonian channel is just a fourth one. Yeah, the very serious problem in Estonia and in Latvia is, I would like to present this slide. It's a question about trust in media. And yes, you get the answer that Russian Estonians trust Russian media most, but I would like you to check the third column. The question is, do they follow the media? And the answer is that they 63% they even don't follow Estonian media. The answer is that 62% don't follow Estonian internet media. So Lithuania, not so much the case, but Latvia and Estonia, we have societies living in totally different media environments. And the result is quite interesting, because if you would follow those Russian media news documentaries and so on, it's a history issue from 2005 and even previously. And we have even dynamics when asking Estonian Russians about their views on occupation and voluntary entering Soviet Union, the dynamics are even changing. So when finalizing with the Baltics, yes, isolated media environments, but not the case in Lithuania. Lithuanian Russians and Lithuanian Poles are still, they are in those different media environments, but they still follow Lithuanian media. So therefore, there is juncture points. And I would like to raise a question. You know, in energy discussions, we have this free-riding issue of Russia free-riding European market in energy and so on. The question is how Russia free-rides European media market, I think one to think about. And the question is that we are probably in the Baltic states looking too locally into our problem. I see Baltics just as a test ground for Russia entering European market. Because if there were Eurobarometer survey about language use, in European Union, in the population, 6% know Russian language. 6% in European population is 30 million. In the Baltic states, we have just 1 million Russian speakers. So just to, as we are the Baltics and our other colleagues did the Ukrainian, Moldovan, and Georgian case, I would like just to run quickly through Ukrainian example. I like this quote of Yushchenko quite much because 2008 was the year of decisive events in Ukrainian media market, actually. And those events started with his position about the problem. You can see that he stated in the National Security and Defense Council, the biggest threat to national security of Ukraine is information expansion of foreign countries, naming Russia. So after this, there were decisions of closing some Russian channels. But the problem, I think, I understand the Ukrainian government and politicians saw at the time was not about the quantities of Russian media use, because you can see from here that in Ukraine, TV channels are not so much in top of the list, you know, of being watched. I think the question here is mostly about the topics or this stick issue in media environment, the topics being used to raise tensions in the society in different regions in Crimea and so on. So different topics, Ukraine and NATO, Russian language use in Ukraine, as a Baltic fascists, in quotes, the same with Ukrainian fascists, pro-Russian slogans during elections, and so on, and the problem of Crimea. When we move to the issue of Moldova, then we get again to the position of probably Estonia and Latvia. We see this in the total population, not just Russian-speaking population, that Prime TV, this is Pervy Kanal in Moldova, is the primary source for the information. Not local Moldovan channels, not Romanian channels, but Russian channels. And what is interesting is the paradoxes that arise from this in Moldova. Our colleague who did the research put those paradoxes in front that the virtual neighbor of Moldova is not Ukraine, it's Russia. The other paradox is that when there are surveys on public figures, the major public figure in Moldova is Putin or Medvedev, not the local political elite. And of course, the same in Moldova and the same in Georgia, the problem of those breakaway regions where it is totally uncontrollable situation in media environment, and those regions totally belong to Russian media space, not just, you know, geographically. And I would like to finish with a Georgian attitude towards this problem. Georgians usually have a straightforward idea of how to solve problems in different situations. So this is a print screen of Georgian public broadcaster's new project called First Caucasian Channel. So they just did on the basis of Pervy ORT Kanal, on First Channel, they did their own Russian language TV which is now on internet, and they then tried to put it on the satellite to transmit it to Russia, but unfortunately they got cancelled because Gazprom Media went with better offers for the satellite retransmitters. So this is from my point of view. I would like to thank you for your attention. And on this question slide, you see how Estonian government tried to solve the crisis during Bronze Soldier time. Those who don't understand Russian, the one SMS is, says that don't fall to provocations, stay at home. And the same is done in the email that was sent all around Estonia in Bronze Soldier crisis. So this is the idea of how media can be even hard political tool, not just an issue of soft power. Thank you.
Thank you, Neris, for a very interesting presentation. I've seen a lot of this information before, but this was, again, something new and interesting, especially the Georgians.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I will briefly... I'll try to not take a lot of your time anymore with the presentation. So I'll briefly elaborate on the Russia's cultural influence in these countries, and also with some major grand conclusions that we got out from the study. When speaking of Russia's cultural influence, some things had been said already before by Anderson and Nerius. First thing to take into account is the preconditions, which are really favorable for Russian culture to be spread in within the Baltic countries and in Georgia, Ukraine, and Moldova. It is language, and of course the media environment and media, Russian media, which are really broad, representing in all the countries. Language is, I think, one of the most common pillars of Russian cultural influence, because there are nearly 90% of populations in Baltic states that can kind of understand Russian language. So that means they can understand Russian cultural artifacts, movies, music. Sorry, put it further. And also media makes it even easier for Russia to spread that. The other thing what actually makes us concerned, it's not about, you know, getting rid of the Russian culture in Latvia. It's all about the things that we see kind of risky. The first one, concerning the contents of the culture, we can see a lot of messages on historical nostalgia of the Soviet times. And this, of course, mostly works to the Russian-speaking minorities within the countries, but also within the older generation whose youth had been in the Soviet times. And, of course, they still remember also some great movies, some music, and so on. It's youth. Well, no one sees the bad things in that. At the same time, it's not only about retranslating or rebroadcasting, you know, the old cultural artifacts, the old movies, and so on. Russia's film industry, for example, it's really working hard on getting the good image of the Soviet times in Russia and in Baltic states and so on. So this nostalgia of the Soviet times kind of makes Russia's image, also in our countries, look not so bad at all. And this is one point that makes us cautious. The other thing that actually could be said it's even more risky is that we see messages when there is a promotion of some anti-democratic values within these cultural artifacts. There had been cartoons for children where Russian Tsar was asked, "Are you a democrat?" And he says, God forbids, no. Believe it or not, but it is a message that already children get. And what is even more interesting, this cartoon was retranslated in all the Latvian kind of national commercial channels also. That means that these messages also reach the population not only of the Russian-speaking minorities, but also the overall population of Latvia, like Latvians, well, we can call them like native-speaking Latvians. And here we come to the audiences, which are also, in case of Russia, quite favorable, because there are large groups of Russian speakers in Latvia and Estonia, in Ukraine, Moldova, not so much in Lithuania. At the same time, as Nerius explained before, there are a lot of people who understand Russian language, and they also get the same messages, the same images about the culture. Overall, we can say that regarding the spread of the Russian popular culture, Moldova is the case that was the first place on having the amount of Russian cultural artifacts which are the newly made. Because there are a lot of, actually most of the movies in the cinemas are still the Russian language. There, even the Hollywood movies are remade in the Russian language also, because it's cheaper to buy from Russia, you know, already made. In case of Moldova and Ukraine, it is also very important to know that there is a role also for the Orthodox Church, who plays also some political role within the countries, and there have been attempts to separate the church from the Russian, from the Moscow Patriarchy, which is a really influential one. But in case of Moldova and Ukraine, these attempts have not been brought to the result. Georgia has a little bit different situation, because it's also mainly Orthodox. Their church is really separated from the Russian one. And in case of culture, when we speak of Georgia, we can clearly see the importance of the context of soft power. Because when there is an open conflict between two countries, it's really hard for Russia now to make its cultural influence on Georgia. This is because of the going against, you know, everything that comes from Russia. At the same time, when we spoke at the presentations also, and presentation in Georgia to the some researchers and other interests, they said that they kind of see more and more Russian culture coming in now, the movies, the theaters, and so on. So there are still things ongoing even without this, taking into account this context. And even in case of Georgia, where the conflict was not far away, not long time ago, it is already starting to work from the side of Russia. Maybe one example for me as a Latvian, which is kind of important, and I think also here in the U.S. you would understand that, about the ice hockey. We have the Russian-made league of the Continental Hockey League, where a team from Riga is playing. And this is actually one really great example of how Russia is making its image. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm a fan of Dynamo Riga, of our team, and I followed how they beat one of the leaders now at the playoffs. We're really happy. Well, some said that it's because of the Gazprom money, and it is kind of true. Because when settling up this team, some connections, some companies connected closely to the Gazprom gave the money without asking anything back to settle a team in there, in Riga. So on the one hand, I'm happy that we have a good hockey team that can play in quite a normal level. On the other hand, it again makes me cautious. What will happen when the money will end? Will there be any demands, maybe, in the future? So this is kind of what makes me also cautious. More in details. We can also discuss during the question session. And I would like to conclude with some major points that we have stated during the study. First of all, whatever it would be, the hard power means or the soft power means, it must be taken into account that Russia acts from the positions of power politics. It is still about control, about influence, about power in its neighborhood. And sometimes maybe the using of the soft power means can make us get sleepy on that. Sometimes we cannot see it clear. But I would like to really stress that the power politics, the position of power politics, it is also stressed by Russia officially, and it is done in practice. The second thing is about responses, the overall thing. We understand, and all the researchers in our countries were agreed on that. Of course, the first thing we must do is our domestic homeworks. We have problems within our countries. In case of Latvia, Estonia, this is a question of integration of the Russian-speaking minority, of getting it, you know, getting society more closer to each other, and reducing the effects of the separate media environments and so on. We have, of course, some other decisions that should be made also on a political level, and the political will is needed to do that. And we also hope, and we have also stated, you know, some things within Latvia that there needs to be a political will to solve those issues. On the other hand, there are external responses also needed. And the point where I'm getting here is more about, as an example, media. We cannot, our countries cannot compete with Russian media because of the large money put in there, which of course produces more quality products maybe than we can do on our own. And so by this, we really hope and look forward for other media, from European media, maybe US, to come more and more in our market of media. This could help to balance the information, also for the Russian speakers, as well for our societies.
Let's try and finish, because we have to be out of here by 10 minutes. So.
Yeah. And this policy that is stated, it still should be regarded as lasting policy that will not change because of the political course or change of the leaders in Russia. By this, we want to take the advice of Dmitry Trenin about Russia, that he said that the best that Russia could do for its smaller neighbors would be to become more stable, prosperous, and at peace with itself. This, together with a more enlightened approach to dealing with its neighbors, would give Russia considerable soft power, the ability to convince the others rather than coerce in the region. And we hope that Russia will hear these words by Dmitry Trenin, not by us, and take them more seriously, because it's we think this is one part of the solution. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much. We're going to try and get as many questions in as possible, so just have one round. Let me make just one very quick comment. going back to the beginning, difference between soft power and humanitarian dimension, or human dimension really is what it should be, depends on how you define soft power. And there are almost three degrees of softness, you could say. Narrowly, I would say, as a means for pursuing international communication and cooperation, it's almost soft without power. It's so soft it's without power. Or, which I think you're talking about a little bit, a firmer soft power. In other words, intended to spread cultural and political influence through media, minorities, and other mechanisms. And there's also a third thing, which you don't really talk about, and I'm not sure whether you cover it in the book, is hard soft power. In other words, how to impact government through bribery, corruption, blackmail, inducements, influence within political parties, parliamentarians, etc., etc., with some energy components or some other shady deals. And I think you sort of touch upon this a little bit, but not too much. You're talking really about this sort of medium soft power, medium influence. In other words, it's not a question of just spreading influence, but gaining influence. That, I would say, is the difference between soft and hard soft power. Anyway, let's open up to questions and comments, please.
So, my name is Fodor Ujanovsky from the Embassy of Moldova. Thank you all for the presentation and references to Moldova. Moldova becomes more in the orbit, which is good for us. And thank you, Janusz, for organizing a very good event for our private.
Vlad Spino from the Moldova Foundation. Just a few facts. And comments. Great work looking at the region and see the similarities. In the case of Moldova, just two examples about the soft power of Russia. Their embassy is by far the largest in Moldova. It's more than 100 personnel at least listed, which is, to compare the institutional power or institutional capacity in Moldova, it's more than the Minister of Foreign Affairs personnel in Moldova. And the second thing is that the Moldovan NGO listed the journalist of Russia in Moldova, and it's also more than 100, comparative to other countries like Romania was till recently one or two person, or from Germany one or two, or from Great Britain and so forth. So this is just following up on my colleague from the Moldovan embassy is that you mentioned this point, that it's very important looking at the countries and seeing their institutional capacity and help from outside, especially in the media, to help them to present a competitive programs that would be able to let the audience to see what is good and what is bad. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I will start being really short. With the soft power, it's a question of definition, as with everything. But when you put forward the question of this hard soft power, question of corruption, and this goes, this from radical perspective into more soft, into economic influxes and so on, then you tend to, when being in the academic world, you tend to find out that, this is not a realm of academic people, but more of a special services realm, especially on hard, soft power, corruption and issues like this. And therefore, we, in this research, we really stick to the notion of getting into the depths of humanitarian dimension as it is understood by Russia, but not into those dark or gray economic transactions. From my perspective, the question was about EU media, yes, being coming into our region and so on. I actually, from Lithuanian perspective, I don't know how in Latvia and Estonia, but from Lithuanian perspective, I am very skeptical in the sense that previously we had even better situation. Previously, I mean, 10 to 5 years ago, when there was a Scandinavian media capital in our countries, what happened actually that they realized that this is a too small media market for them, and they decided to sell out, and the ones who bought the media market in Lithuania were Lithuanian local media, not media people, but business people. And the very problem now in Lithuanian media market is actually that we have too few international media companies here, media investments here, and those local media people, they are mostly using media as a, not a primarily business model, but as a secondary tool to how they have different businesses, financial, and so on, and media just helps them with achieving goals in this primary business, but not media business. So that would be a skeptical evaluation of Lithuanian situation.
Yeah, there was the question about the commercial and soft power interests of Russia, whether we have separated them. Well, we haven't, because when we speak, when we read from the side of Russia, from government and business, that then they say that everything on the side of culture is about commercial things. In this case, it's so interrelated because of the media owners, because of the state ordering the cultural products, and even saying by what purpose it should be made and how it should be made, then we don't make a clear distinction between these two things. I agree that it seems kind of blurry in this case, but we actually wanted to keep it like that because it is. So...
The gentleman from the Moldovan embassy asked about specific approaches, how to formalize and whether to formalize. I guess the point that I wanted to make is that we can look at the settlement of such disputes as a game and not really from any sort of game theory, but rather in rather simplistic terms, that there are different games and different approaches to games, and therefore it is only a very natural thing for those who play the game to pick the game where the rules are more favorable to them, or at least, importantly, where the rules are not greatly favorable to the other party. So in the Security Council, in the negotiation of the European Union, Russia certainly has a much stronger position in more formalized settings, and George has exploited it very well in the European Court of Human Rights and International Court of Justice. It becomes much more equalized. And I think that there are two elements here. One is that Russia is very much prone to such informal approaches, but the other post-Soviet, post-communist states are as well. There isn't that, I don't know, legal aggressiveness, sort of the bloodthirst. I don't know what would be a better way to put it. And that is what I would like to suggest. That is, one should consciously try to see the game field where one can prevail. I think George here, I would like to emphasize a positive example.
I'd just like to add something about media. Ownership is not always a solution of problem. Like, for example, in Latvia, Mr. Murdoch bought one of Latvian commercial channel. It's a fifth channel. And what happened to content? Nothing. This channel is buying cheap programs from Russia, some humor and some TV shows, and this content is like the same. So it's like third channel is Sweden channel. Also, sometimes during the evenings when I check out our not just Russian TV channels, which are quite easy to get through cable television and which are quite popular, but also Latvian commercial channels. And sometimes during the evening, all channels like Russian and Latvian channels spread out some Russian shows, TV shows. And you cannot find something in Latvian. Maybe just our, not state channel, but we called it society channel, where is something in Latvian language. So it's not so easy.
Yeah, there was also the question about business transactions. Well, we didn't actually looked at this. We didn't focus at that. And this was also the point about the soft and hard power that you mentioned before. We really started with the humanitarian trend, how it's outlined in a foreign policy review. And then we saw that there are a lot of things which are really common with the soft power issue in original notion proposed by Nye, which excludes the economic things out of it. So we still found it a great framework to be started on, and we continued to explore that one.
Okay, that's a good luck sign, isn't it? Thank you very much. This is just a foretaste of the study itself, which I look forward to reading, and maybe you can in future do something more on the harder soft power as well. And come back when you do. Thank you all very much.